As you may recall, last night I mentioned that this is a traditional moment in the Zen calendar, Rohatsu it's called, where we celebrate the Buddha's awakening, the historic Buddha's awakening. We also celebrate our own awakening. Because we are already awakened, even if we're not aware of that. Okay? That was what the Buddha's awakening was, that seeing that all beings throughout space and time are already awakened. They all have, another version is, they all have the wisdom and virtue of the one who is awakened, the Tathagata. You know, sometimes we can say it's the awakening of the whole universe, so we're celebrating it now. That's the nature of the universe, of all things, is awakened, to be awakened. Its nature is already awakened. So what does that mean for us? What does that mean? Awakening, different definitions of it. Basically, it means to experience the interconnection, the oneness of life, of all things. So, for example, we see that when the sun comes out, it's warm. When the sun goes behind the cloud, it's colder. There's a direct an interconnection between the sun coming and going and how we feel. Okay? We can see the interconnection between milk and cheese, or the cow and the milk. We can see that they are related and that they have the same nature and they produce, according to their forms, they are presented differently, they manifest differently, but they're one. So these are very basic ways that we can see it. And one of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, used to give these very simple examples, saying that if we have awakened to, we've all awakened to the oneness of something, right? Most of us have awakened to the oneness of our body, so the one body. Very aware of this is one body. So this foot and this hand and this hair and the lungs and the eye, it's all one body. And we think of it as being mine. Right? So, and when one part of that body is hurt, we experience it, and the whole body sometimes hurts. When we become ill and we have fever, the whole body aches. When something joyous happens, or we have some nice wine or something, the whole body feels joyous. That means to awaken to the oneness of the body, of our body. And we're all very familiar with that. We can also awaken to the oneness of our family. We think of our family as being one body, in the sense of we're very close and we pay attention to our family, and we are more affected by what happens to our parents, children, cousins, than to someone else's cousins, children, parents. It's natural, because that is we experience that as the one body of our family. If our child is hurt, we feel that differently than if someone else's child is hurt. Of course, we may also experience a sadness or a sorrow for the other child who is hurt, but it's not the same as my child. It's very different. or my parents, my mother, my father dies, it's different than when your father dies. Although I may have compassion for you and wish that he had a peaceful passing, but it's not the same thing as when my father dies. So we can also awaken to the one body of our neighborhood, or our apartment building, or our city, or our nation. People who speak the same language as us. People who belong to the same institution, who went to the same university, who practice Zen. We can awaken to those aspects of one body. So these are sort of relative examples of awakening to the one body. When we awaken to the one body of the universe, that's something different. Then we see the absolute interconnection of all beings and things throughout space and time. So there's no separations between times, neighborhoods, so no time and space separations, no age, sex, religion, race, gender, preferences of all kinds. It's all one. And so Bernie Glassman used to say that you could see the awakening of someone's, the depth of someone's awakening to the one body of the universe by how they served people, how they served others. Because that's what it is, right? It's you, if you have awakened to the oneness of it, then you are attentive to the others because they are you. They are your body, the one body of all beings. And therefore, you are attentive and you serve them when what you respond to what they need, as you would to yourself. So when you're hungry, you eat. Or when you need to go to the toilet, you go to the toilet. Or when you, cut your finger, you take care of it. When you awaken to the oneness of the universe, you attend to the universe in the same way, with the same attention. And a good example so is what I suggested to you this morning about Orioki. So look at the room as the one body. And so pay attention to the others. What are they doing? What do they need? If you don't know what to do, look at the others. They are there to serve you with their example. That goes for us sitting here showing others how to do Orioki. That goes for the servers helping each other or helping the people, moving the condiments from one side to the other or helping his server who is running out of food or something. It's all about being aware and attentive to the oneness. So that's what we mean by awakening. It's awakening to this oneness to better serve. And because when we serve the others, we serve ourselves. If we awaken only to ourselves, then we will serve ourselves really well. Although, not really, because when we only serve ourselves, we're not really serving ourselves. When we awaken to the oneness of the people who support the same team as we do, we may be serving that team very well, cheering them, wearing their colors, paying monies to go see them, whatever it is that you do. But we're not really serving ourselves or the other teams by just focusing on our team. That's something that we're familiar with. We all know about sports and how fanatic people are about it. But it's the same goes for groups of like this, right? So we become fanatic about Zen. And we think that anyone who doesn't practice Zen is not one of us. But the truth is, that you don't need to do any practice like this to awaken to the oneness of the universe. This is just a method, a vehicle, a form that we've put in place to help us to awaken to that, to the oneness. This morning when we were talking about the seats and the what to do in Oryoki and not to do in Oryoki, I was reminded of considered one of the great bodhisattvas in Buddhism, Vimalakirti, who was a contemporary of the Buddha, so 2,500 years ago in northern India. And there's a sutra named after him. He was considered to be one of the most enlightened, the most awakened, one of the deepest awakenings of the people around the Buddha. And he was a lay person. He was not a monk. He did not join this community, taking off his clothes and taking into monk's robes. He was a lay person. He had a family. He was a businessman. And yet, he was considered to be the one with the deepest awakening. So all the disciples of the Buddha sent people to go see him. Go ask Vimalakirti. Go see him. He's a great example. Listen to what he has to say. So they did. And in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's a whole kind of mystical, mythic thing with 84,000 great thrones and all the bodhisattvas and all the realms. Let's just talk, okay? The point of it is, I mean, that all is important and it means something, but that's not the subject that we're coming to today. So one of the ones who comes is Shariputra, who also figures in the in other stories and chants that we have. So he goes there because the Buddha told him to go there. And I won't go into the whole elaborate story of how all the others came too, but he looks around and it's this really small room. And Vimalakirti, who was often sick, was lying there on a bed or on a couch or something. And there was only one chair in this room, this small room. And Shariputra, he looks around and he doesn't understand because supposedly all the bodhisattvas of all the realms come and sit there with Vimalakirti and throngs of the masses, the people come to hear him talk. So Shariputra says, so if that's true, why is there only one chair here? And Vimalakirti says, Shariputra, did you come for the chairs? Or did you come for the Dharma? The Dharma being the teachings, but also all phenomena, right? All beings and things is also the Dharma. So, did you come for the chairs or did you come for the Dharma? Shariputra says, oh, I came for the Dharma. And then Vimalakirti goes on, and there's a whole thing that happens, and all the thrones of enlightenment descend from the heavens, and they're too big for people to sit on, and all kinds of fantastic things happen. But what concerns us is, did we come here for the chairs, or did we come here for the Dharma? So did we come here for all these rituals and forms, or did we come here for the Dharma? Did we come here to do Oryoki perfectly? And even what is Oryoki perfectly? Maybe what we did this morning is Oryoki perfectly. Did we come to have, you know, all perfect seats and zafus of all the same color? And some communities you can't sit on a chair. And if you sit on a chair, you have to sit outside the room because it's not correct, right? So that's coming for the chairs. That's not coming for the Dharma, right? And I don't mean to be criticizing what someone else does, because maybe they too are coming for the Dharma, and that's their way of coming for the Dharma. My experience with my teacher, and my teacher's teacher, and his teacher, and my other teachers, and the wider communities that I've participated in, we come for the Dharma, not for the chairs. So then, okay, what is the Dharma that we've come for? What does that mean, the Dharma that we came for? And a little side story about Vimalakirti. This is a really famous incident, this story about the Vimalakirti's room. And I forget when it was, but a great Chan master, a Chinese master, and, you know, probably in the 8th or 9th century or something like that, traveled to northern India to the place where Vimalakirti supposedly had lived, and because he wanted to measure the size of the room where there was only one chair. And he wanted to see the place, and then he wanted to measure the room. And so he measured the ruins. There apparently were the ruins of it. And it's the equivalent, it has a name, and that's the name that I had to write down because I would forget it. It is one square zhang, Z-H-A-N-G, which is about the equivalent of 10 square feet, which is what, that's like 3 square meters maybe? Or maybe not even, yeah, I don't know, something like that. Not very big. The room, the ruins of this room, right? And so it has this name, one square zong, which in Chinese is fong zong. And so now, this is where it gets really crazy. In traditional Chan and Zen, the abbot's room in Chinese is called zong chong, or in Chinese, Hojo, referring to Vimalakirti's room. And it's theoretically supposed to be that size. So 10 square feet or 3 square meters, the abbot's room is supposed to be that size. And probably there are Zen and Chan communities that respect that. Probably there aren't very many, though. Maybe in traditional Chinese and Japanese temples, but in the West, I'm not so sure. Was it like that in your community? It was received, that was what it was called, and it was that size.
Okay. Child, yeah.
Okay, so that does still happen. So, you know, it kind of sounds like coming for the chairs, you know? If we have to, it probably isn't for those communities that do that, but if we decide that we cannot practice, if the abbot's room is not that size, then we get lost, you know? And so in our community, it would absolutely be impossible because I'm not an abbot, right? One, I'm a lay person. Well, Vimalakirti was a lay person too, so. He was not an abbot either. He didn't have a temple. His house was his temple. His garden was his temple. As we say, you know, the earth is our temple. In our Sangha, we say that, so. We say the universe is our temple and the earth is our altar in the Wildflower Sangha, so. So if we start, you know, getting caught up on all these things, it's like getting caught up on the chair instead of just coming for the Dharma. Okay, the chairs aren't right, according to some rule. The Oryoki didn't follow all the traditional stuff. And yet we ate together with whatever attention we brought, following a ritual, letting go of our attachments to how we think it should be and how it shouldn't be, what is right and wrong, and we just had breakfast together. Recognized that we were being served, the server served us, even if it wasn't the, you know, orthodox chair, or it wasn't the orthodox way to do it. We have absolutely no chance, in fact, of doing it the orthodox way here where we are. You may have heard me tell this story, but my teacher tells this story. They used to do angos, like 3-month retreats in Poland. And this was in the mid to late 80s. So this was before the fall of the wall, and it was complicated to get there, but it was really cheap. So they could rent, like, you know, this ski resort place for nothing. But it also meant that everything else was pretty not great either. You know, it was hard to get toilet paper, and the food was kind of limited, as it was in East Bloc during those days. But because it was so cheap, it wasn't cheap for the Polish people, but it was really cheap for the Western Europeans. And so throngs of them came. So they would have these angos of 150 people in Poland for 3 months. And they would do like 3 of them, one after the other. So they would stay there for all this time. And to one of these angos, a Japanese monk came. Someone who knew Maizumi Roshi, who was the abbot of our lineage, who brought the teachings to Los Angeles from Japan. So some monk that he knew who was traveling around Europe came and stayed there with them for an ango. And they were all really happy, and they were excited, and they thought they were doing everything like they should do. And they were all wearing their robes and perfected. They had been doing this for months on end, so they really were doing orioki and doing it all right. You know? So my teacher's teacher was not there at this moment. He couldn't stay all the time. So she was kind of running the thing, although she had not yet received Dharma transmission. And so at the end of the ango, the 3 months, they ask the monk, you know, what he thought, and you know, he said, you know, so can you suggest anything that we could do to be more, you know, orthodox or something? And he kind of sighed. And he said, just keep doing it like you're doing it. And they said, oh, really? I said, that's great. And he said, because it's all wrong. because it's impossible in a Polish ski resort to have, like, the exact size of the abbot's room, to have the exact size of the zendo, to have the amount of steps you need to enter the zendo, the separate place where you have the Dharma talk and the place where you sleep that is the same place where you sit, and all of the stuff that you would have in a Japanese monastery. And he absolutely, he said, continue as you're doing. Because they were doing it not paying attention to the chairs. The heart, the soul, the essence of the practice was there, and that's what was important. So that's what my teacher had received from her teacher, and her teacher had received that from Maizumi Roshi, who was coming from the really orthodox Japanese tradition. And even in his center in Los Angeles, which was pretty orthodox, you know, zendo is not an orthodox zendo, you know, kind of has an L to it. Nothing is orthodox. And here was this guy, like, raised and did all his training in Japan as high as you can go, and transmitted to his students, it's not about the chairs. It's not. So when we come here, it's important. The rituals and the forms are important. because it helps us to, it gives us a structure that limits our distractions. It may not seem like it. It may have seemed like breakfast was just total distraction for those of you doing it for the first time, or those of you who know how it is and were saying, oh my goodness, what are they doing? Why are they serving this at this moment? And what's going on? And whatever. Why isn't that person doing this? And whatever. It may seem like distractions, but our attention is heightened. Everybody's attention, everybody's awareness was raised. It would have been a different experience if we had all gone and sat at the table and everybody brought their own lunch, their own breakfast, and ate whatever they usually eat. Completely different experience. So already that was a total Oriyoki experience. The essence of Oriyoki, of what this practice is about, was there already. But if we start getting caught up and saying, that's why I said to you this morning, it's a lot of information. It's okay, whatever was going on. Next time, pay attention, raise your awareness even more. That's what we say when we come to, the traditional word for a retreat is seshin. So it's to gather together, join our hearts. It's to, shin is a word that is both heart and mind in the Asian languages. But it's this heart-mind, so it's both that we gather together our own heart, we're not so dispersed and distracted by coming here, and we also bring our collective hearts and minds together. So we gather with others to gather our hearts together, but also to gather our heart together, and being with the others in this structure, in this, all these rituals, that helps us to do that. Because that allows us to have a taste of what the awakening that we're talking about is. The interconnection. Also, when we walk, when we do the kinhin, we think of it as being, I'm taking a step, and then another step, and another step. The person in front of me is taking a step, and then a step, and another step. We think of it as like individual steps, one after the other. But actually, it's one step. It's one continuous step, like a dance. We're all doing the same step. Manifesting differently, but we're all doing one step. And if we can let that into our mind, the experience of walking is very different. And it's easier to then be aware of how the other is walking, and then we don't go too fast. Or, which is more common actually, is that we pay attention to how the other is walking, and so we don't let a huge space between myself and the other. If we're only attentive to how we're walking, often what happens is we walk really slowly. The very first time I ever did that walking, that kinhin, was I came to a retreat. My woman, who is my teacher now, and who I had met outside of a retreat, I just met her in her apartment, and she invited me to come to this retreat. And I knew nothing. I knew how to sit. Someone had showed me how to sit, and I was doing that alone in my apartment. I also asked her to show me how to sit when I met her alone in her apartment. And so I knew how to sit, but I didn't know anything else. So then when it comes this moment to walk, nobody told me anything. Everybody else there knew what they were doing. And so, okay, I just kind of stood up and said, well, I'll follow the person in front of me, I guess, I don't know. And I noticed that everybody was walking really slowly. So I said, okay. So I just walked really slowly. And by the time, no, maybe then they did the fast walking, and I realized everybody was walking fast, so I started walking fast, and I came to the door, and a guy, a monk, probably the head monk, although I didn't know this kind of thing, called me out, and he said, "Do you know how to do this walking?" And I said, "No, never, no clue, you know." And he said, "Well, you were walking too slowly. Everybody was waiting behind you." Of course, I didn't realize this because I wasn't paying any attention. I wasn't looking behind me, and I didn't know. Nobody told me, okay? Well, of course, I was just horrified, but at the same time, I was like, okay, now I know. And he explained to me, you know, this is how you walk, and this is what you do with your hands, and whatever. So I went back in the Zendo in my shorts and t-shirt. I also didn't have any idea what you were supposed to be wearing or anything. And the next time I did it fine. So it's all about awareness. So I was just focusing on myself. I wasn't paying attention to anyone else. I was paying attention saying, oh, they're walking slowly. But I wasn't paying attention to anyone else. And when then I could pay attention, then I was more aware of the one body, of everyone walking together. It's not each of us walking alone, it's everyone walking together as one. It's a really deep and powerful experience. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher, used to, when he talked about walking, and they do a different kind of meditation while walking in his community, it really is very slow walking, but they do it almost individually. He said, it's as if you are kissing the earth with your foot. That's a way of bringing the earth into this one body, of not only all of these bodies as one walking in one space, but also the earth. Pay attention to the earth that you're walking on. Here it's really cold. One of the first times we came here, Nuno brought, I can't remember if it was like long yoga mats or cardboard or something. It was cardboard, yeah. And put it all around in front of all of our seats so that when we walked, it wasn't cold. It was a sweet initiative, you know? It was coming from an attention to the oneness of serving, you know? I think we abandoned that after that first time, but now we just put on warmer socks. We just fully experience the cold floor. And now we can see what happens if we extend this, so the one body of our body, the one body of our family, the one body of our friends, the one body of our community, our sangha, the one body of our city, of the people who speak our language, whatever it is. And we see what happens when we don't see that. So Bernie said we can tell the depth of the awakening by how people serve others. We can also see the absence of awakening by our actions. And usually that is expressed with what we say that becomes obvious to what we call the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance. Ignorance being the basic not being awake to the oneness. And there are depths of ignorance too. Just as there are depths of awakening, there are depths of ignorance. So there can just be the ignorance of not paying attention to your neighbor who's having trouble with Oreoki. And I'm not saying ignorance in like that's bad, shameful. It's just, you know, we just weren't paying attention. That's kind of one depth. We can see the depth, a deeper depth of that ignorance when, for example, you know, we see war. We see how people, this is a really deep, deep, deep ignorance, you know. When we kill people because they don't believe the same thing I believe, or because they don't look like me, or they don't talk like me, or they eat differently, or they, you know, they have a different religion, different race. They live on the other side of the border. So, and even the fact of creating the border and making it impossible to cross it, that's a reflection of the depth of ignorance. And then it takes these forms of anger, which is violence and aggression, greed, you know, withholding, you know, starving people or not allowing them to have water or people who, you know, directors of businesses who take most of the profits for themselves instead of sharing it with the people who make the products. Many different manifestations of the depth of ignorance. And the same goes for the depth of awakening, of awareness, of enlightenment, as we say. And it doesn't have to be, you know, we can have a really deep, our awakening can be very deep, and the manifestation that that takes is by helping our neighbor with Orioki. So it's not necessarily the quantity of what we do, it's the essence of it that's important. So when I say, you know, the really deep ignorance, genocide or killing an ant. We're not going to, we got into this really big this summer in our retreat, so we're not going to go back there. We're not talking about moral equivalence or anything, okay? I'm just talking about the fact that when we don't see the oneness, we do harm generally. And when we do see the oneness, we do less harm. Let's just put it that way. And this awakening, again, as I say, does not depend on having a Zen practice or a Christian practice or any kind of spiritual practice. There are people who are absolutely deeply involved with spiritual practices and don't display much conduct of awakening. And there are people who have no official spiritual practice of any kind and are manifest great awakening. So it doesn't, it's not linked to the chairs, in other words. When Vimalakirti said, did you come for the chairs or did you come for the Dharma? That's what he's pointing at. It's not about the chairs. And the chairs are a metaphor or a symbol of all of our concepts, all of our ideas, all of our positions, that when we let go of them, you know, if Shariputra truly lets go of coming for the chairs, well then there's no problem. He sees things as they are. So we come here, actually, as I said, it's supposed to be December 8th, so it's supposed to be a week from today. And in traditional Zen communities, usually we sit all night, that night, through the night, to honor what the traditional historic Buddha did. He sat all night through the... And then in the morning, we saw the morning star. That's the story. Well, initially, I had understood that we were having this retreat on that day. And then there was some confusion about the conversation I had had about those dates, and it turned out we had already booked this place for this day, so we couldn't do it on that day. So, am I going to be stuck on the chairs? Or am I going to come and do the retreat and honor the Buddha's awakening and give ourselves a taste of that awakening? Or am I going to say, oh no, it's not possible on December 1st, it has to be December 8th? No. Okay. We'll do it December 1st. Or the weekend of December 1st. Usually it's a whole week that culminates on the 8th. So it's very convenient this year because all the Zen communities can start tonight and finish next week, the traditional communities. But fortunately for us, we weren't attached to that. So we can be here now. We could be here together, we could come from all of our busy lives with all of the things that are difficult and painful and happy and joyous and all of that, put it aside and come here and sit together, bring our hearts together and have a taste. Celebrate the Buddha, what he indicated to us. As I said, like last night I said, he too came late to the party. He too realized that it was already happening. He just didn't see it. You know, it's kind of like you wake up in the morning and the sun is up. And you don't really think of it like that, but it's like, oh, the sun came up while I was asleep. It's all going on while you're asleep. It's all there while you're asleep. Or when the sky is covered with clouds and you go in an airplane and you go up there above the clouds and it's like, oh, it's sunny up here. Whereas when your view is clouded by your thoughts, your ideas, your limitations that you put on yourself, you don't see that it's the sky is vast and blue and limitless. It's not actually blue, but and there is actually no sky, but we call it that. It helps us, you know, it's like calling up the chairs. It helps us to represent what has no form. So the sky has no form, but it helps us to represent it, that word. So that's what this awakening is about. It's like awakening to what already is, that what we don't see, though, the interconnection, the true nature of things. So first of all, it's your true nature. Like I said, you are the party. So we come late to the party too, and what you realize when you get there is that you are the party. You already are it. And you think, oh my goodness, what have I been doing all this time? But you've been doing it all the time anyway. Everything you've been doing brought you to this moment, so that nothing is lost, nothing is wasted, and yet we chant at night, hey kid, don't waste your time. And yet, at that moment, when you have that taste of what it is, when you, like Buddha, come to the party where everybody's there all at once, you see, nothing was wasted. And you're exactly where you need to be. At this moment, you're exactly where you need to be. And everything is as, everything just is as it is. And if you traced it back, you would see the interconnection and the karmic, the actions and the consequences that brought you here now. But actually, there is only here now. So, this is it, right now. That's the good news and the bad news. You won't become someone else. That's the bad news. But the good news is you don't need to become someone else because you're already magnificent now. That's the really good news. You don't need to be somewhere else. You don't need to be someone else. The party's right here and you're it. Just look at my notes and see if I noted anything that I didn't want to forget. Yeah, just that, you know, when I say this, you know, your true nature or your original nature, who you are before all of the stuff that you, all the ideas you have about yourself. That's like saying, you know, when I say that, that's the equivalent of Vimalakirti saying, you know, did you come for the chairs? So, did you come here so that everybody would see how great you are? And so that you could continue to, like, you've had to kind of give up your usual clothing and your usual way of walking and talking and your usual activities, so you can't really present yourself like you usually do. We're kind of forcing the issue, kind of saying, forget all that stuff. Like I was saying about talking, even, you know. Forget all the stories that you want to tell people so that they'll think you are someone, or so that you will then think you're someone special, someone extraordinary, someone worthy of love. Usually it comes back to that. We want people to love us because we don't love ourselves. Because if we love ourselves, then there's no problem. When we truly love ourselves, we truly see who we are and we see who the others are. And we don't need to prove anything. And then we won't fall into the shame or guilt or blaming others for not doing it the right way or not being who we want them to be. We see people, we see things, we see the moment, we see the universe as it is when we see who we are. And that's beyond ideas and concepts. And all these rituals and forms help us to let go of those ideas and concepts. That's, I guess, what it is. So the chairs are worthwhile if they can help us let go of our chairs. Maybe something like that. That sounds really Zen jargon, but it's true. Use these chairs to let go of the chair. So I guess I'll open it up, and if you want to ask questions or share something about your experience, or ask a question about what I've said if it's not clear, or if you want to go further with it, something.
I want to share an experience. Listening to you talking about form, and I was reflecting, this is my third retreat, so I haven't started that long, whatever that means. And on my first retreat, which was in summer last year, I was quite anxious not getting things right, even because I had dyspraxia, so I had problems with coordination and movement, so getting, doing lots of things. Give me a book of concepts and I'll translate it for you. Give me a note and I'll be there for a day. You know, so it's not... And then, yeah, I was anxious about it. By the end of the retreat, I had relaxed a bit. On my second retreat, which is, so this is summer 2 years ago, but on my second retreat, which was summer last year, something different was happening. I was still anxious that I wasn't getting things right, and now I'm serving, so again, I'll be anxious that I didn't get things right, less so this time around. But I've noticed that I was also doing something else, which is I was focusing more on form. So I'm just like, should I get things right? How do I get things right? What if I do this wrong? What if then? It's not. I was focusing on form because I didn't want to relax into what I was feeling. I didn't want to let go. I didn't want to rest into what I had to feel at that point. So therefore I was focusing on the form. And when I finally managed to say to myself, just let go for a while. Let go of that. Let go of the form. If you do the knot wrong, you do. If you don't try not to cross, the sort of altar, but except for that, if you do something wrong, you do. Now relax and breathe and see what's happening at this point. And then as the people were there in summer, no, I cried for 4 days. No, when I finally let go of the attachment to form, which was an experience I'm incredibly grateful for, much as what can be grateful for crying for this, but I am. So, I guess I want to say that sometimes it's not just about the social anxiety, I get things wrong in front of other people, it's about our own internal defense. Let me focus on form so that I don't let go. And it takes courage, I think, to let go of that and let go.
Yeah, thank you. That's an example of what happens when, some people become really, really good at form. They can do it all perfectly and really, really good, and they almost become ayatollahs of, you're not doing it right, and this is how it's supposed to be done, this is the orthodox way, and then telling you you're not ringing the bell right, or you're not stepping in the zendo with the right foot. You're supposed to step with the left foot, not the right foot, and all this stuff. And it is true, it can be that, we really take it so intensely so that we don't have to feel, maybe.
And maybe the person doing that and policing somebody else's form is using the same defense.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So they're extending the defense, what they do.
It can be. I'm not saying everyone is, but it's an example of what can happen. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
And it can happen too that when we then relax, we actually become more fluid with the forms, because we're like really tight with it. We're not doing it right, and we're wondering if people think what they're thinking and whatever. Whereas if we just relax, this is the experience of ringing the bell. The Jikido can say this. If anyone who has rung that bell much knows that when you kind of just relax into it, it's a much better sound. But when you're really uptight about it and thinking, I want to do it right, and all this stuff, it's kind of ding. and when you don't know the bell, and you're not used to it, and you're really worried, you're not doing it at the right moment and everything. The more you do it, the more it becomes familiar, the more it becomes fluid. You let go of doing it right and wrong, and then it's really fluid. So it kind of works the same way. And that's a metaphor as well for life, for our lives. Because when we're really attached to an idea of who we are and how we want to be and what will make us happy, we generally enter into the samsaric experience of just fueling more unhappiness, because what we think will make us happy is actually just causing more misery. It wears out. Fires, it breaks, like us. And nothing can fill what we're trying to fill, because we don't see that we are already full. It's really a vicious circle. And when we see ourselves doing that, we have compassion for ourselves and say, oh wow, look what I'm doing. I'm trying to make myself happy by buying all these new clothes when I really don't even need those clothes. And maybe someone in a Chinese prison made them, forced labor. I read this story this morning, I don't know if anyone else saw this story. Someone in England ordered a coat online from some British company, which I'm not familiar with. Regatta, do you know that thing? Yeah. And ordered it online, and when the coat arrived, put it on, and the elbow was kind of tight. There wasn't much movement in the elbow. And she felt it, and there was like a rectangle there or something. So she cut open the lining of the coat, and inside it was an identity card, a plastic identity card, which she then found out through translation was with a photo on it, a photo ID, of a prisoner in a Chinese prison. And she looked up the prison, and it is on the website of the prison or something. It says that it manufactures clothing and appliances and things like that. So she called she contacted the company, Regatta, and said, you know, are your clothes made in a Chinese prison with, you know, forced labor? Oh, no, that's not. That's just probably an ID of the worker. It's nothing to do with the prison. Yeah. Throw away the card, you know. And she kind of thought about it. And then they called her back. Several people from the company called her back and said, actually, can you send us that card? And we'll check it out. And we'll send you a new coat, because you ruined your coat. And we'll send you another coat, too. You know, hoping that she would zip it up and not say anything, and they would have the card. But she didn't, and she told journalists about it, and now it's become this story of clothing made in a Chinese prison with forced labor. All this to say that, do we really need that coat that's made by people, forced labor in China? You know? We can't control all of our clothing where it comes from. We can't control all of the products that we use. We can't eat only organic food. We can't, I just bought some fabric in Lisbon, and all of the fabric was made in Portugal, and I was so happy. And the reason I chose it was because it was the nicest fabric. When I was feeling the fabric in the stores, those were the nicest ones. And then the guy said to me, oh, you know, these were made in Portugal. They didn't come from China. And they come from this factory, a traditional factory in northern Portugal. Great. You know, so we can buy nice things that are made here. We can't control it all. Right? Can we have the awareness, though, and pay attention and try to do the least harm? That's what this glimpse of awakening teaches us, to see the interconnection, to see the causes and effects, and to see when we might be doing harm and try to limit that harm.
Sorry for you gave an example. I think we must be aware that not that coat was made by forced labor, but a lot of things in our world are made by forced labor, cheap labor, and maybe also slavery labor. It's not only that coat.
Absolutely.
The auto system is based on that.
Exactly. And that, you know, when I said about, you know, the owners of the companies taking all the profits and not giving a fair wage to the people who produce it, and that inequality, that's part of it too. And there's some of it that we can't control. We can act in our lives. Every moment in our interactions, that's where we can have an effect. It won't change that, you know, what Elon Musk does, or Bill Gates, or, you know, the Portuguese government officials, or government officials everywhere. It's not just political.
Right?
What's left of it? What's left of it?
That's right. You know, but yeah, it's a good point, Pedro. You know, it's like it's limitless. The greed, anger, and ignorance is limitless. But so also is, you know, the enlightened aspects of those, you know. The enlightenment is the flip side of ignorance. Generosity is the flip side of greed. And love or compassion is the flip side of
anger.
They're also interconnected, but it's hard to remember which is which. But and they both are limitless and present at every moment. Because they're limitless and beyond space and time, they are present at every moment. And we have the choice. Each of us has the choice of which we would like to give our attention and how we can act on that within our one body, which, as we say, is this body. It's this body, but it's also the universe. So how can we act? Just because someone else doesn't act from a place of generosity, love, wisdom, doesn't mean that we shouldn't, right? And it doesn't mean that the situation is, whatever situation we're in, is impossible. At every moment, awakening is present. That's what the Buddha saw. Every moment. It's already here. So I met this guy the other night at the talk that I gave in Lisbon, whom maybe some of you in Lisbon know, Fernando, who was one of the people who created the Buddhist Union in Lisbon. But he also created this organization that's called CASA, which most of you probably know, right? It's this organization that feeds people who don't have food, whether they're homeless or they're poor people who don't have food. And he created this organization, CASA, and just, I guess, probably first in Lisbon, and then it expanded throughout Portugal. And then it's expanded, apparently it's huge in Brazil. He tells me that it exists in France, it has a different name in France, and I don't even know what other countries. So just this one guy, maybe with a couple of friends, decided to feed people who were hungry. In his neighborhood, probably. And now he said they serve like, I don't know how many hundreds of meals a day, just in Lisbon. And every day of the year. There are many, many organizations that do things like that. And whether it's feeding people or, you know, we have Doctors Without Borders, we have Lawyers Without Borders, and we have all kinds of things, but you can do that you do it for your own body already. You take care of your own body. You take care of your family, you know. If your family needs food or something, you'll share it. What about your neighbor? What about your friends, your colleagues? It doesn't necessarily mean giving food, it just means giving attention. Sometimes the best thing you can do for a homeless person who's asking for money in the street is to say hello, to look at them, to recognize them, to see them. They're being seen. Of course, they would like you to give them money, but it really is a deep experience for someone when they've been really seen. It doesn't take any great action. In fact, there is no big or small action. There is just responding appropriately to the situation. So that's what we're doing here. We're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, because when he saw that, that changed his life. Changed our lives. His life was, from that moment on, transformed. And that can happen for each one of us. I know that's what happened to me. My life, from one moment to the next, whew, never the same. So, we're here to honor that, to celebrate that, to say it's possible for me too, and to have a taste of it during this 2.5 days. How are we for time?
2 minutes.
Okay. So I guess we will stop there, and we will end by chanting the four vows. Thank you.